Sometimes, a single moment can change a person's entire life. Like when documentary filmmaker Ken Burns saw his father cry for the first time.
It was after my mom died. This one film had given my dad permission to express real emotions.
Or when Sal Khan, a hedge fund analyst, decided to tackle the impossible and educate people around the globe.
When the IRS asked you to mission statement, I filled out free world-class education for anyone, anywhere.
I'm Alicia Burke, host of the new podcast That Made All the Difference, where I talk to achievers about the moments that inspired them to make an impact. This season, along with Ken and Sal, I'll talk to news anchor Dan Harris, Thrive Global founder Arianna Huffington, Mary Davis, CEO of Special Olympics, and athlete and chief inspiration officer Loretta Claiborne.
I thought to myself, who cares about us? But I saw something totally different, that somebody did care.
You can find That Made All the Difference anywhere you get your podcasts. Created by Bank of America. What would you like the power to do?
To what extent is the Trump presidency a product of television? James Poniewozik will be here to talk about his new book, Audience of One. What are the consequences of our failure to look ahead? Bina Venkatraman will be here to discuss her book, The Optimist's Telescope. Alexander Alter will give us an update from the publishing world. Plus, our critics will talk about the latest in literary criticism. This is the Book Review Podcast from The New York Times. I'm Pamela Paul. James Poniewozik joins us now. He is the chief television critic for The New York Times, and he has a new book, his first book. It's called Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television and the Fracturing of America. Jim, thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot for inviting me in.
Well, let's start with your day job, because a lot of people probably wonder, what is it that a chief television critic for The New York Times does?
A chief television critic watches a lot of television. Increasingly, because there is so much television, a chief television critic has to do a lot of triage and decide what not to watch and what, you know, sort of merits attention. Relevant to your interests, the way I describe this to people nowadays is that when I started out back in the ancient days as a TV critic, it was more like being a movie critic, you know, where you could reasonably see every major release and see everything that was out there.
When did you start?
I started as a full-time TV critic with Time magazine in 1999, so 20 years ago. So, you know, seen a lot of change over that time. And now it's really more like being a book critic, in that you just have a stack of material on your desk, and a lot of it is just, you know, cracking the cover and seeing how fast this grabs you and moving on and sampling a lot, but recognizing you're never going to be able to experience everything. You have to sort of try to sample wisely.
And you are not the only person writing about TV at the Times, right? So as the chief critic, do you kind of say, all right, I get to do Succession and I do, you know, whatever else it might be. These are mine.
We're pretty much, and I think in all the departments where we have multiple critics, we're pretty much a democracy, in that a list goes out of here's what's coming up and we weigh in on what interests us. And honestly, we kind of have complementary interests, me and Mike Hale and Margaret Lyons, and there are also other critics who occasionally, John Caramonico, will jump in and do, you know, like a music-related thing or a reality show here and there. Mike, for instance, has interests in a lot of international series that I don't have as much time to keep up with, and I'm glad to, you know, shunt that off to him. So, A, we kind of try to spread it around, but B, because there's just so much of it, you know, more often, if there's somebody else who's interested in doing a big thing, I'm glad for them to, you know, take that load, because ideally, again, this is a function of just there being so much stuff out there. Rather than try to just review as many things as possible, I'd rather try to weigh in on fewer and the things that there's really something to say about and, you know, take the time to do that. One of the blessings of being at an institution like this that has multiple critics is that you can do that a little more.
Right. Well, there are some people out there in the world who would love to be book critics. But for a lot of people, it's, you know, oh, God, you know, too much to read, too much time sitting around reading. And probably for many of those people, being a movie critic or being a TV critic just sounds like the absolute best job in the world. You know, it sounds like, oh, you just sit around watching TV all day and then you get to, you know, then you have to just write something.
Eating bonbons. Yes.
But it's probably not entirely like that. Like, what's hard about it?
Well, I mean, you know, your fantasy of being a TV critic is that you'll watch the TV that you want to watch and, you know, you'll spend your time with that. And, you know, a lot of being a TV critic, like being an anything critic, is watching things that you don't want to watch, sifting through it. Also, again, just this intense guilt feeling of there always being more that you can do and always more that you can cover. I mean, look, it's not working at a coal mine, you know. I have a great job. I love that television is about everything, and it gives me a chance to write about everything. On the other hand, television is about everything, and there's so much fascinating stuff out there, so many fascinating genres, that I would like there to be five or six of me sometimes.
So when you're reviewing a TV series like This Is Us, and I just read your original review of season one because I watched it on an airplane and then wanted to know, okay, what does Poniewozik think? That's very different in that you're reviewing, obviously, the acting, the production values, the substance of the show, the stories they're choosing to tell. But when you're reviewing, let's say, a TV debate or a presidential live appearance on television, how do you navigate between reviewing the production of it, the message of it, versus reviewing, let's say, the president, or reviewing what would be considered the content in that sense?
If I'm covering a presidential debate, I'm not a subject area expert. I may, you know, have some knowledge of tax policy, but it's not very much. I may have opinions about that, but nobody should care about them. But I am focusing on how people in those forums are sending those messages, their manner, their affect, how they're often creating a character on the stage and how they're positioning themselves in comparison to somebody else, whether their arguments are, you know, emotionally manipulative or evasive, et cetera, et cetera. So I prefer to leave the actual subject expertise to subject experts who are reporting this stuff. But I also think that there's sometimes a critique of political coverage of political events that it's quote-unquote theater criticism.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's anything wrong with quote-unquote theater criticism.
What does that mean?
Meaning talking about surface details and presentation and how somebody's approaching an audience and how they're maybe being received by an audience. And I actually think that's super important because that wins and loses elections. That changes the direction of countries. I think, you know, the point is just to avoid bad theater criticism.
Right.
You know, hopefully, like, bring something in and bring something to that is both showing people, okay, here's what you saw and here this is how this was working on an audience, and not ignoring the substance of it, because the reason that people care about it is because of the substance of what's going on and the real consequences of it.
All right, bridging over now to the book, how has the Trump presidency, Trump's election, changed your job as a TV critic?
It's just made it more. I mean, it's, you know, there's one more thing on the pile. Covering the overlap of television and society, something that I've always done, always been interested in. But suddenly, there is this 24/7 reality show going on that everybody is watching the live feed of, that is dominating the cultural conversation, that is just this fire hose of content to take in. And it is starring somebody who literally is a character who built himself in the medium of television. To me, it's sort of malpractice not to analyze that because I am a figure-outer of television.
Mm-hmm.
So I have focused more on that aspect of my job than if we were living in slightly more boring times.
All right, I'm going to get to the book, which is Audience of One, in just a second. But we talk a lot about book criticism on this podcast, and I can't help but want to ask a parallel question of you, which is something we think about here with books, which is, to what extent do you write a review thinking, this person is on all likelihood not going to watch this TV show? I just want to have this piece of TV criticism be a piece of great writing in and of itself? Or do you think of it more as, like, I'm really helping people out and providing a service and letting them know whether this is worthwhile or not?
I think more about the piece in and of itself for a couple of reasons. Number one, you know, you encounter this as a book critic. You know, it's the internet era. There are 5 zillion opinions on just whether something is good or bad. Hopefully, you bring some added value by looking at something a little deeper and bringing more thought to it and writing it better. And that gets to the other half of that, which is that as a critic, you're like half an entertainer. If you can't tap dance for an audience and hook them and, you know, entertain them, like, I don't think entertaining is a pejorative, then what are you bringing to the table? Criticism is a very valuable aspect of journalism, but like, you're not uncovering the Pentagon Papers. I'm not revealing to people things they've never encountered before so much as that I'm, you know, hopefully getting them to think in a little different way about something that they've already thought about. You kind of have to be able to spin a good tale and spray a little seltzer and like have a sense of humor and make people laugh. In that sense, like just being able to like write a really memorable piece that sticks with people as a piece of writing is more valuable.
Well, I tell listeners this not only because you are my colleague, but also because I think they will enjoy your criticism. Your writing is very entertaining. It's very entertaining in the Times and also in this book, Audience of One, which is a subject that I wasn't particularly inclined, I have to say, to read about at length, which is, it's a book about Trump. It's a book about television and about the relationship between the two, but it gets you really from the very beginning. And you uncovered some very early Trump on television clips, one with Tom Brokaw, and then another one, I guess, that appeared a couple months after that, that was really interesting considering where Trump eventually got to be. Can you tell us a bit about that?
It was with Rona Barrett, a TV personality and gossip columnist who people of my vintage may remember. She was had been on Good Morning America, went over to NBC and was producing a TV special called, I believe it was something like Rona Barrett Looks at the Lives of the Super Rich.
That's such a 1980s title.
She did, and she said, and this is, I think, one of the things that made her very prescient is, you know, she said, I think that what people basically care about is money, sex, and power, which made her one of the perfect early interviewers for Donald Trump, who she sits down with. At this point, he's, you know, sort of a young real estate businessman, hasn't done that much. But she has the presence of mind to be the first one to ask him, would you ever want to run for president? In retrospect, his answer is very interesting. He says, no, I wouldn't. And one reason that he gives is because of television. You know, he says, well, you know, a controversial figure, somebody who might have ideas but might be a little unpopular, they won't do very well in the television era, which tends to reward, I think he said, you know, somebody with, you know, a big smile and a happy face. The thing is, like, he wasn't wrong, you know, at the time. In 1980, when the culture was different, the culture of television and media was different, the politics in relation to that, because so much of the polarization of politics has to do with the polarization of media, that was different back then. And I write about that early in my book because it's sort of the framing for the idea of my book. How did we get from there to here where a very polarizing, very pugilistic, very confrontational individual is able to get elected president precisely because of, I mean, arguably for no other reason than television. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the answer has to be that America has changed in some ways and television has changed. And that's really the arc of the book.
One other question is, has Donald Trump changed? It feels like there's this ongoing debate of, you know, whether he's declined or whether he's gotten more extreme or whether he has evolved in some other way. Or has he always been this way? Just perhaps we saw what we wanted to see or you know, didn't see what we didn't want to see.
To ask him, he never changes. I mean, one of his quotes to one of his biographers was, I'm still basically the same person that I was when I was 7 years old. And, you know, I think in the broad strokes, that does seem right. However, the Donald Trump that I'm writing about in the book, which is really not so much the person as the TV character Donald Trump, the public-facing performance, he sort of evolves over time. And he evolves in ways that correspond with the changes in the tone and the format of media. So if you watch him in his early interviews around 1980, not only does he speak in much more sort of diagrammable sentences, people have said, oh, you know, maybe that is a result of age and so on, the way he speaks now, but it's also just the mannerisms, the tone, the presentation is, it's much more smooth, pleasing, a little cocky, but playfully cocky. It's the kind of public character that you want to be as a media figure in a time when television is less sharp-elbowed.
There seemed to be, at that time, because I grew up in New York and so was, you know, exposed to Donald Trump in those earlier years, a kind of self-awareness on his part that he was playing a character.
There's kind of a smirkingness to the performance.
Right.
And even over the 80s, you know, I get into this in the book also, you know, as he goes from that very young businessman to building Trump Tower, to feuding with Ed Koch, to, you know, writing The Art of the Deal, and he becomes this sort of peacocky figure in the national media. Even then he evolves. But there is also this sense of, I'm giving you a show. Love me or hate me, but at least you'll find entertaining to watch me.
Early on, you mentioned that there's Trump the performer, Trump the character. You're talking about him like he's any other figure on TV. But to what extent is that the same as Trump the person? Or do you think of them as kind of two different beings, Trump the TV show reality star and Donald Trump?
Short answer is I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of the subtext of our current national conversation right now is that even people who pay attention to Donald Trump every day don't entirely know what, quote unquote, the real Donald Trump is.
And people said the same thing about Reagan.
This is actually a thing that I found very interesting to compare and contrast in the book. You know, with Reagan, he had been a Hollywood actor. He had had this job where he has to put himself in the mindset of other people so much that he can intuit their interiority and, you know, imagine what it's like to be others, to the point where he, you know, famously often had trouble distinguishing reality from his memories of the movies. And he had said that he couldn't imagine how somebody did the job of being president without being an actor. So a lot of people said, well, you know, with Donald Trump, it's kind of the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's, you know, he's an entertainer. He's a performer. He's a master showman playing a role. One thing that I think that misses is that there's a distinction between what it means to play a character in a movie and to play a character in reality TV. In reality TV, when you're playing yourself as a performance, you're being yourself, but more. You're exaggerating the part of yourself that will get attention. You are letting loose and unleashing those controversial aspects of yourself that will keep the camera focused on you. So I think you can at the same time be being yourself in that kind of performance and yet also, like, over time become more provocative, more offensive, because you kind of need to give the camera more of a reason to stay on.
Right. It's a difference between playing a completely other person, a football star or an army, you know, veteran or whoever it might be, than playing a kind of version of yourself.
One thing that I found fascinating to explore in this that's always interested me, the idea of authenticity in our popular culture and how Trump in many ways applied that to politics. There's this notion in reality TV, going back to, you know, The Real World and before, of being real, right? Mm-hmm. You remember you saw The Real World. It's what happens when people stop being polite and start being real. And the funny thing about being real is that it sort of highlights the difference between authenticity necessarily and honesty. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea is that when people are being real, they're allowing themselves to be uninhibited by all the social rules that says you can't say this, you can't say that. And this was a thing that you heard a lot from Donald Trump supporters in the 2016 election. He says what he thinks, you know, which doesn't mean he always tells the truth. It doesn't mean, you know, I trust him to say a thing and that thing is true. It means that if there's something that he wants to say, he says it. Whether or not it's kind or offends somebody or, you know, may not actually be factually accurate, that in this sort of framing of authenticity, that's what being real is. And that's become a very powerful force in our culture.
With this book, on the one hand, you could say, well, this sounds like a narrow subject. It's about Trump on television, right? But it's actually, there's a lot in here. It's kind of a history of television. It's a history of politicians on television. It's Donald Trump's story, but you also talk about Reagan. You talk about other figures in here. And Donald Trump has been on TV for a long time. And then it's a subject, too, that's very much in our faces on a daily basis. Taking those challenges, how did you approach writing this book?
One thing that I kept as my bylaw when I was starting to write it was I wasn't writing current events. I was writing history, even if some of that reflected on today, even if I was going to be writing about Trump's presidency to an extent. I think sometimes when I first describe this book to people, they think it's going to be just 300 pages about Trump watching Fox News a lot, you know, which there is an element of that in there. But really, yeah, I felt that the real story here was a cultural history. It is basically two parallel stories, you know, in the same way that a biographer will sometimes write a twinned biography of two different historical figures who were synced in some way. It's a history of Donald Trump evolving as a public figure from really from birth, but roughly from around 1980 today. And it is the story of how TV and media in general went from sort of a 20th century mass media monoculture to a very fragmented, bubble-oriented, niche media smorgasbord that we have today. That's a big, long story. And, you know, I felt, I don't know if this is a good thing to say about your own book or not, but, you know, there are chapters in this book that I think they could have been an entirely different book.
Yes,
you
there's
know.
A lot in there.
There are probably pages that could be a different book. So, you know, to me, it's not a narrow subject at all. In fact, it's this vast, expansive, I hope, kind of synoptic history that if you read it, gives us the sense of, yeah, like I see what the world was like 40 years ago and what it's like now and how it's different and how it got that way. I'm doing this from the lens of, you know, specifically television and specifically this TV character protagonist, Donald Trump, that fate had handed me, right? Which allows you to do something you don't usually get to do this as a critic. You don't usually get to write things that are stories with narrative and like forward thrusting arc and chronology and a protagonist. I called it somewhere in the book, I think, applied TV criticism, because you're sort of applying those principles to a real thing that's happening in the world.
Well, you're very good at it. There are like 18 other questions I can ask you. We're out of time, but I cannot let you go without asking you this, which is, do you still enjoy watching TV?
Oh, my God, yes.
Oh, good.
I'm not a masochist. You know, one thing that I do not want people to get the impression of from having written this book is that, you know, I don't like TV. I love TV. We have better TV now than we probably have ever had. And I'm lucky to get a chance to watch it. But it's powerful. And powerful things can be used a lot of ways. And you also got to take them seriously in hopefully an entertaining way.
Well, this book certainly does. It's called Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America by James Poniewozik. Jim, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks a lot.
So here's a request for our listeners. I get lots of feedback from you, some complaints, lots of kind words. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me directly at books@nytimes.com. I will write back. But you can also, if you feel moved to do so, review us on any platform where you download the podcast, whether that's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or somewhere else. Please feel free to review us and, of course, email us at any time. Alexandra Alter joins us now with some very exciting publishing news. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
What's exciting?
So one of the most anticipated books, I would say, not only for this year, but maybe for several decades, is the sequel to Margaret Atwood's 1985 classic, The Handmaid's Tale. People have been badgering her to write this book almost since the first one came out, and she has repeatedly declined. But finally, the sequel has arrived, and it arrived in a little bit of a surprising fashion. It was heavily embargoed, as you know.
Yes. Meaning the media gets early copies, and not many of them, and then they are not allowed to do anything with it until a certain date.
Exactly. Everyone agrees, you know, you make agreements with the publisher not to cover it until the publication date because they don't want spoilers out. They want this clean, you know, special rollout. That didn't go according to plan because Amazon accidentally shipped some early copies to customers who started posting about it on social media. So independent booksellers were absolutely furious about this. They felt like it put them at a disadvantage. The publisher apologized and said, you know, it was a retailer error that they quickly corrected, but as a result, all the reviews started flooding out.
So the first one was NPR.
I believe the first review to post was NPR, and after that, other ones quickly posted, and there was concern about spoilers and things. But I actually had the pleasure of speaking to Margaret Atwood several weeks ago in Toronto about the sequel, which I thought was fascinating for a number of reasons. I mean, it really does plunge you right back into this world that she created, this dystopian theocracy that took root in the former United States where women are pressed into reproductive servitude. And it's become very, obviously, timely. It's become almost like a political rallying cry. People show up at Congress and state capitals dressed as handmaids. She's become this political icon. So the work that she wrote so many decades ago has taken on new resonance. Of course, the TV show has contributed to that.
How does she feel about that?
So that was an interesting point that she made when I asked her that question. She is apolitical, she says, in terms of doesn't feel like she wants to be held up as a partisan icon. She said she's agnostic in the classic sense, which is that you can't present anything as fact, which is actually rooted in belief. On the other hand, I could tell, you know, she had sort of a wry look, you know, a glimmer in her eye when she was talking about the protest. She said she thinks it's a brilliant move because everyone can immediately see what you're up to and the message is clear, but you don't have to say anything and you're not disruptive, so they can't throw you out.
I mean, she's not entirely apolitical.
No, she's
very outspoken with Penn and other organizations.
She is extremely outspoken. She's a real activist about climate change and other issues, and certainly women's rights is a big issue for her, but she's always bristled at the label feminist. She's very particular about not wanting to be a feminist. And I think she didn't want to particularly endorse, although she's critical of political leaders and very outspoken, she doesn't want to be seen as a political figurehead, I suppose. But so much has changed since the original book came out that I was curious how she handled even the narrative traps that have been laid by the TV show, which has already extended the story beyond the original book. And I thought it kind of boxed her in a way. I mean, she doesn't want to contradict what's happened on the show. She's very involved in the show. She also doesn't want to pin them in to a certain extent. So it was interesting to talk to her about weaving together some plot developments in the show, which I won't reveal because I think people want to read about them in the book. But she actually picked up on some things that have happened in the TV show and extended them into the book in an interesting way, I thought. So I asked her and I asked the showrunner, Bruce Miller, about that collaboration. And essentially he said, she gives me restrictions. She tells him, you can't kill this person, you can't kill that person.
Oh, wow.
And he gives her information. So he'll say, we're going to do this or that. And together they kind of, I mean, there are some inconsistencies, some significant ones. In The Handmaid's Tale, it's a fully white supremacist society and all racial minorities are shipped off to these horrible colonies. The show is a multiracial cast, and so that's not a feature of the society there. So that's a pretty glaring difference.
But you can see why they would make that choice.
You can absolutely see why, and she understands and approves of that choice. But there are other small inconsistencies, but she said her hope was not to have any glaring ones that would really jar readers or viewers and pull them out of the world. So it's kind of interesting, you know, when you have these TV shows that get made rapidly while the authors are sometimes planning further books. This happened, of course, with George R. R. Martin and Game of Thrones. How the authors kind of navigate that, because their fans also are fans of the show. And so people have this view of the book and the show being like a collective story or canon. And so sometimes authors don't want to be in the situation where they are splitting the story. So now George R. R. Martin has to finish Game of Thrones when there's already been a huge finale on TV. Margaret Atwood has reasserted, in a way, control over her story by capping it with a fairly conclusive ending. I won't say what it is, of course, or how she wraps it up. And she does leave some things open-ended. There's plenty of room for the show to continue because this takes place 15 years after The Handmaid's Tale.
Is there room for another book?
Well, I asked her that, and she was very adamant that, no, she's too old, she said. She wouldn't even confirm that she would write another novel, she said, at her age. She's not committing
to
anything.
How old is she?
She'll turn 80 this year. And she said she's working on her poetry right now. I think it'll be interesting to see how the show turns its plot threads toward the direction of the new book. And they have already optioned the new book, so we know they'll be making that as well, most likely.
Here's a question I have to ask. Since you had time with Margaret Atwood, what's she like?
She is delightful. She's very blunt and no nonsense, but she has a great sense of humor. And if you spend enough time with her and you allow the questions to meander a little bit off topic, she is a very pleasant and interesting person to talk to. She's pretty fascinating. She's incredibly well-read on totalitarianism and how people defect from authoritarian societies. And so she went into a lot of, you know, interesting anecdotes from history, which is where she gets a lot of her ideas for these books. But at one point, we spoke a lot about Shakespeare. She's funny and has a very kind of dark and surprising sense of humor.
And you can read all about the full interview in The Times. Alexandra, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Bina Venkatraman joins us now from Boston. Her new book is called The Optimist's Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. It's reviewed this week in the Book Review. And Bina is also newly named the editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Bina, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Pamela.
All right, let's start with the book, and we may go a little bit into your new job at the end and sort of how these two things might tie together. I want to start with the title. What is an optimist's telescope?
I think of the telescope as a set of tools that can help people look at the future without total despair with a sense of how we can actually invest in the future and make better decisions for the future. So the basis for my optimism is recognizing that we have a choice when it comes to making decisions about the future, that we're not cursed to our current reckless path. And the telescope, I think, is the set of tools that we need, which the book provides, to better understand how we can make decisions about the future.
So this is kind of an uphill battle because it strikes me that people of all ages right now feel awfully pessimistic when they think about the long term, particularly with regard to climate change, the environment, the economy, sort of those big intractable problems. It almost feels like it's easier to find optimism in the short term. And what strikes me, too, is like you see it now. If you're in the middle age region, the greater middle age region like me, you look and you just think, long term, this does not look great. But what's really interesting is that for kids who are traditionally slightly more idealistic and optimistic, they're seeing things in a very pessimistic light, too. So how do you confront that?
Well, this is one of the reasons I wanted to write the book. I teach undergraduates at MIT, and I see a lot of despair among young people today when they think about the future, when they look at the future. And I certainly felt it myself, the sense that things are going very awry in our politics and on the planet, in our economy. But the basis for the optimism that I found is the research and examples that I've documented from around the world that show that we actually have more choices than we think. And I think there's been a dangerous misconception that our current course, whether you're looking at human nature or the nature of capital markets or the nature of human society, is condemned to this kind of short-sightedness. And when you see the signs around us, that can seem like it's the case. But what I really wanted to do with this book is expose the choices we have, the ways that we can actually orient businesses towards long-term ideals and values, the way that we can affect our politics, the way that in our individual lives we can actually imagine different kinds of futures. And I think it's at moments of despair like this when we most need to invest in the future. And if you think about the history of this country, looking back to the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl, there were people in our society, FDR among them, that were able to envision something other than the current state of despair and therefore make the investments to bring society towards a different reality where there was a bigger social safety net, where there were more jobs created, where new infrastructure could be created around the country, where soil conservation could come into play. And I think we're at a similar juncture today where there are a lot of immediate signs of trouble on the horizon, and we have the opportunity to actually correct course. And I open the book with a quote from James Baldwin, which is, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." And I truly believe that that's an orienting quote for our time, because if we don't expose the sort of misconceptions we have, if we just assume that we're cursed to this current course, we certainly won't correct it.
All right. I'm sorry. I'm going to be mired in pessimism a little bit with my questions, but perhaps you'll lift me out by the end. Let's just say you're one of those MIT students, right? And you're thinking, okay, on a granular level, on an individual basis, what can I do? If you're talking about those little changes that, you know, kids are learning now in school from a very early age that they can do, like turning off the water when they're brushing their teeth, making sure that they compost and recycle, thinking about, you know, urging their parents to get solar panels, you have a very strong, almost dominant narrative, counter-narrative coming from economists married with, I don't know, not climate change denialists exactly, but maybe climate change pessimists, I don't know, who will say, none of that matters. That's not going to move the needle. Whatever you do is insignificant compared with much bigger things. Are they wrong?
I'm not in total disagreement with that point of view, in the sense that I think that some of the individual actions we can take, while they're important and they're part of how we develop our own consciousness, they can be sort of like the gateway drugs to a greater environmental consciousness if you recycle, if you use efficient light bulbs and all of that. I don't think those are the big levers for affecting the problem of climate change, for example. And the book really, that's why I wanted to build up from the individual to look at what businesses and organizations need to do, and in fact, what communities and society need to do. Because the individual actions, of course, if we aggregate them, they can be very powerful. We can look at energy use. If we look at the consumption patterns around the U.S. and the number of SUVs that people drive, right? If we could actually affect that person by person, it could have a big impact. But it's probably a more powerful lever to figure out how we get effective policy to bring down emissions from vehicles, from cars, and also from our power plants and beyond. But these things are connected, because if you look at how people vote, a lot of people are voting now based on their immediate interests. And what I hear from a lot of young people is their great concern about issues of climate change, issues that are going to affect their future. And so part of what we need to do, I think, is bridge the gap between the people who are voting with concerns of the future at the forefront of their priorities and people who are continuing to vote sort of based on the immediate fluctuations in the stock market. And this does have to do with changing individual consciousness. It's not as simple as changing a light bulb. It's not as trivial as just whether or not you decide to bike to work one day. Though I think those things are important. But it's much more about, how do we hold our leaders accountable? Are we willing to support policy changes? And I'll give you an example. There was a recent Reuters survey which showed that the vast majority of Americans are concerned about climate change and want aggressive action on climate change. However, if you look at that same poll, you find that a lot of those people, the majority of them, would not support a tax, a carbon tax, that would actually move us towards that. So there's a disconnect between what our aspirations are for the future and how we're actually willing to support the policy change. And that's where I think individual consciousness and action really matters. And there are tools we can use to bridge that gap. I think of them as tools that aid imaginative empathy. For example, there are a set of behavioral scientists who've started an initiative where they invite people to write letters to their children and grandchildren 50 years in the future to try to bring into their consciousness a vivid imagination of what that future looks like. Because if you look at the cognitive science around how we think about the future and plan for the future, we tend to plan for futures that we can vividly imagine. So even if it's totally unrealistic, we'll believe that we can win the Powerball, or we will believe we might get attacked by a shark when so few humans get attacked by sharks worldwide every year. But we don't have a high capacity to imagine futures we've never experienced or that we can't vividly summon in our minds. So sea level rise, which is slow and inexorable and not detectable sort of on a day-to-day basis. We don't look out at the coast and see that the sea level rise has changed. And so for these kinds of threats that lie in the future and opportunities, frankly, that lie in the future, we need a set of tools that allows us to inhabit those that can bring us into the political consciousness where we are holding our leaders and our institutions accountable. And also, frankly, as investors, people who hold pensions or 401ks, we want to have those investments be aligned with what's important in the future as well.
You start your book with your own personal story, and it has to do with a tick bite. What happened, and why tell that story?
Well, it's an example of my own recklessness and my own sort of neglect of warning signs. I was working in the White House at the time, and I went for a weekend hike in the Hudson Valley in New York, and I got a tick bite. Even though I had a rash and I had some itchiness, I sort of ignored this tick bite. And 8 months later, I had a horrible case of Lyme disease. And it took a month on an IV drip of antibiotics to treat it. I ended up having knee damage. It was a really difficult time in my life. And I neglected the bite in part because I was so busy and distracted by the immediate concerns in my life, which also happened to be working in the White House on climate change. So there was a bit of long-term work involved as well. But I use it as an example to talk about the fact that this is a difficult thing to do, to look ahead. It's not easy in our culture, which is driven by instant gratification. It's not easy in our work environments where we're being measured by our immediate results, by what we've accomplished today or tomorrow. And in fact, I found that when I worked with companies to try to help them prepare for the impacts of climate change, like floods and droughts and wildfires, I would meet with these executives from companies around the country, and I would try to talk to them about the impacts to their bottom line, to their supply chains, when there's going to be these droughts coming in the future or heat waves. And I would find these executives looking at me and shaking their heads and saying, I'm very concerned about this. I'm concerned about this problem for my children and grandchildren, but I really don't have the motivation from my shareholders or my board. They're holding me accountable for the profits I'm going to make next quarter. And so I found myself reflecting on my own focus on the immediate. I was constantly replying to emails and just focused on what was right in front of me and neglecting my own long-term health. I found a parallel in that. And I really feel that this is a human problem, that we do have a tendency, we're vulnerable to focusing on the immediate.
So clearly some of this is structural, that we're sort of set up in a way that encourages very short-term thinking and short-term actions. And you also mentioned that there are cultural influences on our thinking. But I also wonder how much of this is just human? I mean, is it biological that we grab that bag of potato chips, that we buy that Powerball ticket, that we eat the marshmallow right away rather than waiting for the two marshmallows? Like, is some of this just built into us?
We certainly have that part of our nature that indulges in the immediate. And in many cases, there's nothing wrong with that. There's something to be said about indulging in immediate pleasure. And in fact, our impulses serve us really well if we want to dodge a car that's speeding towards us or if we need to flee a burning building. But we also have within our nature the capacity for great foresight. And this is why we are the species that has built civilization. We are the species that's put people on the moon. We have the capacity for what's known as mental time travel, which means we can project ourselves into the future, we can imagine the future, and we can plan for the future. And what is really interesting to me and what I found in the book, in the research I did for the book, is that this is not some ingrained and immutable trait in human nature, whether you're able to think ahead or whether you're focused on the immediate. In fact, it's something that can be changed based on the conditions that you're in, the environment you're in, the culture that you're in. And it's so interesting you bring up the marshmallow test, because what we find when we look at the body of research that's happened since Walter Mischel's original marshmallow test, where he had the kids at the Bing Nursery School at Stanford test whether they would indulge in one marshmallow right away or wait for the second marshmallow, is that the vast majority of the evidence shows that the conditions that children are in when they're given that test affect whether they wait for that second marshmallow. It matters whether they trust the authority figure who's promised them the second marshmallow. It matters whether they have a peer group that they've been told also waits for the second marshmallow or doesn't wait for the second marshmallow. And what was so surprising to me was to look at the studies comparing Cameroonian toddlers with German toddlers. Hmm. And it turns out that the toddlers of Cameroonian subsistence farmers are passing the marshmallow test at a much, much higher rate. It's something like 70%. They're waiting for the second marshmallow, while German and American toddlers tend to pass it at a 30% rate.
They know about waiting for that harvest, I guess.
I guess so. And so one of the things that this points out is that the cultural norms of a community can really affect what we think of as ingrained human nature or as ingrained human frailty.
All right, so that's Germany versus Cameroon. Let's talk about the United States. Are we particularly bad at this, at long-term thinking, or is our system set up in such a way that it really discourages long-term thinking and inhibits it?
I think it's a combination of culture and institutional factors and motivators and incentives, if you want to use that word. American culture is certainly encouraging instant gratification. We have the technologies that are reducing the friction between what we want and what we can get. And so immediacy is becoming more and more conditioned and part of how we live. If you just look at, you know, how quickly you can order up a car to take you somewhere through one of the rideshare services, or how quickly you can search for something on Google, it actually will anticipate what you're looking for and complete your query before you've even thought of what your query is. And Isaac Newton wrote about the difference between absolute time and relative time, time as we experience it. And I think if you think about relative time, we are really compressed in how we think about how much time we have and how quickly we need to do things. But that's also being encouraged by organizations and institutions. So it's not just cultural in the ether, and I don't think you can exclusively blame technology. But the reality is, there are ways we can buffer ourselves from those cultural influences, and there are things we need to change within organizations. We need to look at, when we measure people's progress, we measure them for success or failure, are we actually measuring what matters over time, or are we just looking at the number of widgets that were made today? Are we looking at what actually builds value? And I think when we measure ourselves in our own lives, you know, I find myself looking at how many messages I've just sent and feeling really good about myself that I sent a bunch of emails today. But is that actually getting my deep work done? When I was writing the book, it turned out not to be the case at all. I could write, you know, 1,000 emails, and if I hadn't written a chapter, it really didn't matter.
Right. And all those emails will come back to you.
Exactly. Right. They multiply themselves. So the sense of accomplishment we get from some of these immediate tasks, I think, often are at odds with what really matters and what we really want to accomplish over time. And we need to figure out how to delink those. And the book has strategies for how we do that.
You have a lot of suggestions of how people can incorporate and encourage this long-term thinking into their own lives and on a larger scale. But let's just, if you could give us one suggestion that people can apply to themselves, what would it be?
One of the tools that I found in my research that I really like is called perspective hindsight. And this was a term coined by Deborah Mitchell, who was at Wharton in the late 80s when she coined this phrase. And the idea is that you imagine a future outcome. Maybe it's having thrown a great dinner party or having gotten a job promotion or having built a successful enterprise. And what you do is you think about that outcome as if it's already happened. And then you try to list the reasons why it happened. So you come up with a great guest list for your party. The conversation is wonderful at your dinner party. And what this does is expose to you the pivotal decisions that can actually lead to that outcome. And it also helps you weed out the trivial factors. Maybe it doesn't matter what the weather's like. Maybe it doesn't actually matter if the dessert doesn't turn out perfectly. And I think this kind of practice can actually help us look at futures, imagine futures as we want them to happen, or imagine futures that we don't want to happen, and clarify the decisions in the present that are actually important to those.
At the beginning of the podcast, I mentioned that you have a new job. You were just named the editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. How do you plan to approach that job using this kind of lens?
There's a tendency in the media environment today to chase page views, and some of that is a market imperative around advertising. And one of the things I think we need to do at the Globe and just generally in order to have an impact with our readers is look at stories, look at editorials and assessments, opinions that are really going to make a difference, make an impact in terms of improving public institutions, helping readers make decisions in an election year. So I'm thinking about this position with a long-term perspective. How are we going to have the most impact? How do we distinguish ourselves as an enterprise that's trying to inform people and bring opinions to people at a time when opinions are cheap, right? Everyone can express their opinion on Twitter or on their own blog or website. And I think what readers need and are looking for are careful, informed decisions, and they're looking to understand and have brought to their attention the most pressing issues of the day. So I think a lot of what we need to do is to be looking at the landscape and asking, what are we neglecting as we look at the incremental? Sometimes the president's tweets are really important in some respect because they cross a line, but often we need to be looking past those at what's really happening structurally in American society. What are we going to do about profound inequality? What's happening in terms of the changing climate that we're neglecting when we're looking at the incremental? So I'm really interested in taking this role with an eye to those problems. And I also think that part of this is that we're at a time of such political polarization, and our public discourse, I think, is suffering as a result of that. And I'd really like to invest in the future of public discourse. It's going to be hard. The change is going to be slow. But I think if you have an eye to trying to bring credible information and reasoned opinions into that discourse, it's not going to always be immediately rewarding, but I think it's going to ultimately have more meaning.
Well, there, you gave us something to look forward to. Congratulations on the new position at the Boston Globe and on your book. It's called The Optimist's Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age by Bina Venkataraman. Bina, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joining us now are book critics Dwight Garner, Jennifer Salai, and Parle Segal. Hey, guys.
Hi, Parle.
Parle, let's start with you. You reviewed one of the books that has been shortlisted for the Booker Prize this year.
Right. And yet again, for me, an immensely long book, which I just seem to be fatally attracted to.
You just did The Catholic School, which is like 1,000
pages.
Talk
to us about your masochism.
I love it. But I'll tell you this. It is masochism, but it's also, in the case of this book, Ducks, Newburyport by Lucy Ellman, a deep pleasure. Like, there's something, for me, so soothing when you're in the hands of a good or even competent writer, and you know, you're like, this is my week. It's going to feel great. It's going to be interesting. It's kind of like, I think maybe I'm like a mollusk in search of a shell. And like, if I can live inside this book, I'm incredibly happy. And I know what I'm going to be doing. I know it's going to be nourishing. So this book is about 1,000 pages. Most of it is told in one long sentence. And it's in the mind of this woman, kind of like a Midwestern Molly Bloom, like this modernist sort of everything that sort of filters into her thoughts, children, her husband. She's thinking a lot about politics. She's thinking a lot about her own feelings of paralysis. And again, it is really long. It can feel a little bit dense the first few pages and you're trying to get a hang of the rhythm, but it's very easy to read. I kind of understand why. And as in the cases of like all the great books, I have no clue. You kind of just surrender to it. And she's got this like linking conjunction that she keeps using, the fact that, and then she has a phrase and then she can switch and talk about toilet training. Then she's talking about Pol Pot. Then she's talking about, you know, she's got a very withering sense of humor and loves to enumerate her failings. And so the book kind of coasts and coasts and coasts, and it does come together at the end with this really satisfying ending. And you feel, or I felt, very much so that the length was not only justified, but part of the project, part of the passion, part of this writer's ambition. Ellman has written, I think, 6 novels so far, very spiky, misanthropic, funny books. But this is her most, I think, loving and easily lovable character. She's got a lot of softness. She's a lot of goodness, even though she's funny. She's a really interesting and good person to spend 1,000 pages with.
I only recently learned that she's Richard Ellman's daughter.
I know. Right. Which I really was wondering whether or not to put in the review. You know what I mean? Because she is, you know, Richard Ellman wrote the definitive biography of Joyce, right? So she must have grown up in this house.
And Oscar Wilde.
And Oscar Wilde. And her mother, Mary Ellman, was a great literary critic who sort of spearheaded feminist literary criticism. So, I mean, this is a thing that I was thinking about. I was like, do we mention these two people? Do we mention the shadow they might have cast? And at the end of it, I was like, no, this is such an achievement on its own. I don't want anybody else to be in this review but her and what she's done. But it is a very interesting fact.
Do you think about that? Like, how much context do you want to provide, and is it sort of detracting in some way if you say who the person is married to or the child of? Or
does it matter? I don't know. It's interesting
case by
to know.
Case.
Like,
case by case.
Sort of glad to know that in some way, but you have to decide whether it's worth deploying in a review.
Yeah, and especially if you like, if it's like a huge book and you only have like 1,000 words, like,
right?
Really?
Did people see this book coming? Because who was the publisher? So it was a fairly minor press, wasn't
it? Biblioasis.
Yeah, Biblioasis does great work.
Yeah.
I just wonder why it seems like this book is becoming slowly a big deal with the Booker long list, and I just wonder if people just thought it wouldn't sell in the States, so other houses didn't bring it out here. What do you think?
I don't know, because she was published, you know, by I think all the major publishers. She was reviewed pretty widely. And then she kind of dropped off, and I don't know why. I think she moved to Scotland, and she became very reclusive. I don't know if that was part of it. And why it's sort of becoming a big deal, I think it's for the same reason why I loved it. You open this book, and you're like, come on. This is such a gimmick.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be so mannered. This is going to be so annoying. And then you're like, oh, no, this is fantastic.
Were you tempted at all to do your review as one sentence?
No. Oh, my God. I don't have that kind of skill. Can you imagine?
Have any of us done that sort of review yet? I mean, the sort of review where you take
you
over the voice.
Michiko Kakutani was very famous for it, you know?
Yeah, Michiko did it often. And I think I almost did it once. I did it in second person once a review, but that's as far as I've gone. They always make me cringe, those pieces, you really, really, really nail it.
Yeah.
Come on, let's all try.
All right. Yeah, now you just set it up, Dwight. You guys all have to nail it.
So, Dwight, you reviewed something this week that also was written by a literary editor and great critic in her own right.
Yeah, I sort of wrote in my review about two books, really. Mary Kay Wilmers is the editor of the London Review of Books, and her new collection of essays is called Human Relations and Other Difficulties. It's essays, and she's just a very spare, cutting, beautiful writer to read. And I reviewed that with a history of the publishing house Faber & Faber, which a man named Toby Faber wrote, who's the grandson of the founder. And I wrote in my review that, you know, sometimes I feel these end-of-the-summer doldrums where every day feels like a Sunday and you're just kind of morose. And somehow reading these flinty Brits makes me, you know, just perk up a little bit. So I enjoyed both these books a lot. Some readers might know Mary Wilmers as a character as well as an editor and writer, because there was a lovely book that came out a couple years ago by Nina Stibb, who was a babysitter for Mary Kay Wilmers back in the 80s, back when Mary Kay Wilmers was married to Stephen Frears, the film director, and had a bunch of floppy-haired kids running around. And Nina Stibbs' memoir was called Love, Nina, and it's a very charming book.
Oh, it's the best. I love that book so much. Although, for a while, I made the mistake of thinking that maybe I should raise my children the way that Mary Kay Wilmers
raised her
children. And then you realize, like, no, they're just going to end up so obnoxious. Like, she was probably doing some other thing at the same time that mitigated it.
I read it when I was pregnant, and I kept telling my husband, I was like, see, it's not that hard. You know, you don't have to actually raise them.
Let them grow like weeds.
Be around.
That's what we did.
You might have been tempted, Jen, to do that kind of gimmick review with your book this week.
Oh, so this week I reviewed Malcolm Gladwell's new book, Talking to Strangers. It's his first book in 6 years. And there is a way in which I think only Gladwell can do what Gladwell does in that sense. So I think it's probably a good thing I didn't
try
to.
That's a very loaded statement, Jen.
You know, take that as you will. This book, I have to say, didn't like it. I think if you're a Gladwell fan, then, you know, he does the same thing that he's been doing in his previous books. And so he's very much on brand. He takes a number of stories that he says shows how strangers have a hard time understanding what one another's intentions are. And so trying to sort of put that in the context of different psychological and sociological theories, and then coming to certain conclusions at the end. And I think, you know, for people who really enjoy the way that he sort of ties all these different anecdotes together, they'll enjoy it. At the same time, though, most of the examples in this new book are very well known. So he takes the examples of what happened to Sandra Bland, what happened in the Brock Turner sexual assault case, what happened with Hitler and Neville Chamberlain. So he takes cases that people have already thought a lot about, tried to sort of parse and explain, and then he brings his own reading and theories into it. And I think that that's where a lot of the problems lie in this book, just in the sense that, you know, you can sort of see that maybe certain things are explained by some of the theories he brings to it, but then some of them are just seem wrong. Some of them are very obvious.
Yeah, it's interesting the criticisms that people lobby at Gladwell, that it's opportunistic, that he's taking other people's research and sort of repackaging it, that he's cherry-picking examples, that it's superficial. That
he's successful and happy, you know?
Yes, I mean, yes.
Everyone wants to bring that guy down.
No. Well, that's another question, too, which is that readers love him. They love him, and his podcast listeners love him. And there was a profile of him in the paper recently by Amy Chozick, and it notes that he has sort of regularly gotten slammed by critics.
Oh, yeah. He has a huge fan base. I mean, my husband is a huge fan of his podcast. So I've listened to his podcast quite a bit.
I'm a big fan, too. I like those podcasts.
And actually, I do think his podcast is quite good. I think one of the things, though, that sort of did strike me in this book is that, you know, the kind of things that he did in the early 2000s, which I think seemed really sort of new and refreshing back then, first of all, he's doing sort of the same thing, but just with different stories now. And also, I just think, at least from my perspective, as a reader and somebody who wants to learn about this stuff, sometimes the way that he sort of fits these theories to these really upsetting, traumatic situations just doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't feel right. It does feel like he's appropriating somebody else's story in order to deploy a theory on it. And so in that sense, yeah, the book really didn't land. I'd be curious to see how readers receive it.
Why do you think they're so popular, though?
Well, I mean, I think he is very, you know, he's very methodical in laying out his case. Mm-hmm. And so even though he's presenting a ton of anecdotes, you know, he really sort of lays the groundwork in a way where you feel like you're discovering something.
Right.
With
he makes readers feel smart.
I can't imagine it's easy to do that in the sense that I think at one point in my review, I say that he sort of lays this trail of breadcrumbs in terms of like little bits and pieces of his theory within the story that he's telling. And then at the very end, he'll come to this conclusion and it feels revelatory, but really, if you really think about it, it's pretty obvious a lot of the time. So I think that he does have those skills to deliberately, methodically lay out a story which you know, I mean, not a lot of people can do.
And in the Venn diagram of his talents, he also captures these two audiences, which if you can get buying your books, you've got it made. The sort of self-help audience and the business audience.
Right. Yeah.
And totally. like your father will read Malcolm Gladwell because he might learn something about, you know, the way business people think or just ideas to move forward in finance. But, you know, anyway, he does a good job of...
But it's also like the pleasure of the procedural, right? Like, it's kind of like...
Mystery.
A mystery. Yes. Like a Law and Order. Yes. Like, it's this kind of like, here it is, and there's the twist.
Right, you know? Right.
And that sort of thing, like, we like narratively.
Right, right.
It's fun to read.
And he was the master of this thing. And back when he started it, he was so good at it. And now the culture has kind of caught up with him. I mean, kind of like Ira Glass. Now, everyone sounds like Ira Glass. But at the time,
everyone
Ira Glass.
Sounds like Ira Glass.
Yeah. At the time, it was just Ira Glass. And Malcolm Gladwell did this thing as well. And now he's kind of been copied by a lot of people. But he's still an original, I think.
There was a period, I think, where every book proposal, it was like, it's like
the new tipping
the
point.
The tipping point meets blah, blah, blah. Or you would see that on the back cover of every review, you know, copy that we got in. Are any of you sneaking in some fun leisure reading on the side as we go into the big fall book season, or does it just become impossible?
Oh, I it's one of my rules for life. I just carry a book anytime I leave the house. So I'm always reading an extra book. I never bring the book I'm actually reviewing unless I'm going somewhere for a long time. But yeah, I'm reading Oberon Waugh's essays from the not The Spectator, but some British newspaper called The Way of the World. And I shouldn't read him. He is really dated in his politics, but he's the funniest
he's a bad
writer.
Influence.
He is the funniest writer. I'm trying to learn about his humor. I just don't, he's just reflexively hilarious. And so I'm reading some Waugh right now.
What about you, Jen?
So I probably can't talk about the actual book itself, but because it hasn't come out yet and so we haven't reviewed it yet, but I just finished reading Ben Lerner's The Topeka School, which is coming out next month.
Yes.
So I won't say anything else about it, but
hold up,
things
hold
will
up
be
fingers.
Said. Things will be said here.
Avert your eyes.
What about you, Carl?
I'm actually just rereading. So my rule for myself is that for every new book I read, I have to reread something.
Wow.
Yeah.
No.
Damn.
Yeah. I just think that you don't understand a book the first time you read it. You miss everything. You're reading for the story. You're reading for the effect. But you don't really see how it's constructed. So I'm rereading a book that I reread all the time, actually. It's a book of poetry. It's called Our Andromeda by Brenda Shaughnessy. And it's a book about motherhood. It's a book about raising a special needs son. It's a book about marriage. It's so beautiful. Yeah. I mean, I think I've now read it like 4 or 5 times and only now beginning to figure out how it works. Maybe I'm just slow. I don't know.
Well, you're a fast reader. All right, let's go through the titles again. Dwight, you reviewed?
Human Relations and Other Difficulties by Mary Kay Wilmers. Also Faber and Faber, A History of the Publishing House, Faber and Faber.
Malcolm Gladwell's Talking to Strangers.
Tuck's Newburyport by Lucy Ellman.
All right, Parle, Jen, Dwight, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.